My name is Walter Licht. I'm a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, where I teach American economic and labor history, and I'm the author of the entry in Preserving American Freedom, entitled Citizenship and Freedom in Post-Civil War America.
And we'll start off with the first question. Why is the battle for enfranchisement so contested throughout history?
It's connected to the question of citizenship. To gain the vote is to be a citizen. And throughout history, there's been a sense in different societies that certain people are worthy of becoming citizens and some people are not. So when you go back to the early years of the new nation, the United States of America, there was a notion then that to be a citizen was to be an independently minded, autonomous individual, because only an independent-minded, autonomous individual could make correct judgments. If someone was a dependent person, dependent on others, where they were at the mercy of others, for instance, they couldn't be independently minded or, the terminology of the day, a virtuous citizen. So at that point, the notion was that if to be independent, you had to be a person who was economically independent, not dependent on others, that you had a skill or property that made you independent. And for that reason, vast numbers of people in the society were deemed not worthy because they were dependent and they would be under the sway of others. So it was considered that women who were not seen as economically autonomous or dependent, for instance, on their husbands or their fathers, would be swayed and therefore could not be true citizens. Obviously, children couldn't be as well, and that's why the notion of someone at the age of 21 could possibly be a citizen. Certainly, slaves who were at the mercy and dependent of their slave masters were not seen as independently minded, worthy of citizenship. And then when you had newcomers to the society, certain immigrants who were largely involved in common day labor, unskilled labor, and also dependent, they too were deemed not worthy or capable of being a independently minded citizen. And I would say even to this very day, that notion holds. It's still contested about who is a citizen, who has the full rights of citizenship. And one of the, you know, the great marks of being a citizen is that you have the vote, that you have the ability to contribute to decision making that affects the greater public. So we have this battle today that there are people in this society who have worked, been in the society for years, worked, contributed, yet they're seemed unworthy because they arrived in this country, let's say, without the proper papers. And that would make them somewhat dependent, not independently minded. And we've even got a debate today about whether people who don't have the proper identification, this is being battled out in many states, should be denied the right for citizenship because they may show up as a fraudulent voter. So this is continues to be contested, and it revolves around this notion that there are certain people who are worthy to be citizens and there are certain people who are not worthy of being citizens. And it's been a battle for those who had been denied that to gain notions that they are worthy, capable, and should be, you know, full participants in the society.
So from your essay, what would you want 6th to 12th grade teachers to stress in the classroom?
I think I would have that teacher emphasize that freedom and rights are not given. They never were given. They were never assumed. They have been constantly contested, and they've had to be fought for. Now, we think of this nation from day one as a nation of liberty, particularly as we came out from under the tyrannical rule, let's say, of the British. in the American Revolution, and that this is the nation of liberty and freedom. That certainly is the rhetoric, that's certainly the imagery, that's certainly the common notion, but if you look at the particulars, it has taken different groups of citizens great periods of time and also requiring great mobilizations and activism to get their claim that, yes, they are worthy. They, just as being human beings, they have the right to be true citizens. So the sense of struggle that nothing has been assumed, given, I would want a teacher to emphasize that, and many of these battles continue in our own times.
Are there any other misconceptions students in those grades might have concerning this topic?
There's an issue of just knowledge. By the way, I teach at the college level, and I also, the absence of knowledge is extraordinary. I mean, if you, even among, students at a terrific university like the University of Pennsylvania, when you ask certain factual questions about, well, when did women get the right to vote, you never get a clear answer. Oh, somewhere in the early 20th century. Even the notion that it's had to be fought at different levels, and that speaks to one of the entries, one of the documents in that is part of this digital project, that this had to be fought at various levels, and the first level was at the level of the state, and then at the level of the federal government. So there's some just base chronology. I hope students, teachers will gather that, and I think also the nature of the struggles and some of the divisions within the struggles. There are a couple of documents there that speak to some of the fractures and divisions within some of these political mobilizations. And very classically, one is as women strove to achieve enfranchisement and real true citizenship, there were divisions among those women on issues of race. Are black women going to be part of this? So there are these kinds of mobilizations, but even within those mobilizations, there's all sorts of conflict and tension, and often on over issues of race.
What do you think is the most important aspect about the Preserving American Freedom website for use in the classroom?
I really appreciate that, first of all, there are very eminent historians who have contributed to all of the entries, and that's remarkable. But how they have attached the texts to real manuscript documents, I think, is a wonderful benefit for students or teachers who go onto the site and utilize it.
So what roles do you think like primary documents play in the classroom to help students better understand a specific time frame?
That's a very good question. I love using primary documents in the classroom in different ways. One way I like to use them is to have students sort of either think of themselves as archaeologists or detectives. So one of the things I often do is present a primary document. It could be a visual document, of a lithograph from a past time, a painting, a cartoon, or it could be a text. And one of the things I like to do is just give the document to the students without any explanation whatsoever and have them begin to try to decipher that document without great help from me or anything else and raise some questions. So can you tell from the language of this or the image, can you guess a time period? And then, why did one student say early 19th century and another student say late 19th century? Try to see if we could, is there clues there that time it? Who do you think is representative? Who is it? If it's a text or a cartoon, do you have any guesses on who wrote it? Not specifically who wrote it, but what kind of person. Did an elderly person write this? Did a child write this? Did a woman write this? Did a man write this? Did an African American write this? Did a white person write this? An immigrant? Non-immigrant, and who do you think this text or image, who do you think the audience of this was? So I like to use that right off the bat without any explanation, and see if just through base knowledge or just being smart, if you could decipher it. And then I raise a big question, well, how do you think we could learn more about this? And that raises questions, well, how do you find information? But I raise questions about how could we find some more? And then I will make some suggestions for some reading. And maybe a week later, after students have done some, try to figure out some background reading, and I give some maybe a lecture or a presentation, we go back to the document, and how do we understand this better now? Well, maybe how do we still not understand it that well? So I like using primary documents because of the kind of detective work that is involved there, and leave it open-ended. I'm not sure all teachers do that. They give the text just as an example of something happening during the period. I like it to be an inquiry, an exercise in trying to decipher it and be a detective. And it's been very, very exciting. The other thing I might add here is if there's language, there are certain words that might not be common to our own age, and there's kind of interesting sort of language skills and trying to understand how people spoke the language and trying to understand the meaning in their own times, you know, not try to read it through their eyes rather than reading it through the eyes of somebody living in the 21st century. I think there are two sources dealing with the struggle of women to gain the vote that I think bring up all sorts of issues about, you know, what takes a long time. I mean, you get that first mobilizations in the 1840s, and it's not going to be until 1919 you'll get a constitutional amendment. But I think the documents that come out of the archives of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania speak to the difficulties of the mobilizations. It wasn't a simple matter, even for those involved. There were lots of tensions and divisions among even those who were involved. The passage of the 15th Amendment, which gave African-American males the vote, was quite divisive for those women who had already started mobilizing on this issue and raised all sorts of racial divisions among women. And then also there's lots of divisions about tactic. Should you just try to achieve this at the local level, or should you put all your energies into a constitutional amendment, which would make it a federal right? Who are you going to mobilize for this? What kinds of alliances are going to make?
How do primary documents illustrate the importance of freedom throughout time?
They raise issues that I think people would say, well, there's the Declaration of Independence and all men are created equal. Well, in fact, that wasn't really the conception. There were notions that, in terms of citizenship, that there were people worthy of this and people unworthy of this. And I think that's an important thing to examine and have students examine, particularly this question of who is free individual, an independently minded individual, an autonomous individual, as opposed to someone who is in a dependent position that might be swayed and under the thumb of someone and not be independently minded. That really complicates the whole notion that all men are created equal, because we begin with certain gender assumptions and racial assumptions, even age assumptions, and ethnic assumptions about who is worthy and who's not worthy. And I think that is really something I don't think that is taught, because we have this sort of pablum notion and easy answer that all men are created equal. So that's, if I was in a classroom right now and I was able to utilize this website, that's the kinds of issues I think that the texts that have been written by historians and the documents that are online can speak to.